From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. After taking a very long hiatus from this realm of topics, we are returning to the world of the Nazis. The Nazi Party of Germany in World War II has become a source of many, many proposed conspiracies and proven conspiracies as we learn more and more about the inner workings of that regime. And nowadays, you know, we can say with certitude certain statements that would have once been considered controversial or conspiratorial. Like now we can say it is common knowledge that many Nazi officials and Nazi collaborators escaped to South America in the aftermath of World War II. It's a genuine, vast conspiracy. You hear them called rat lines, right? Thousands of people fled from Europe to Brazil, Chile, especially Argentina. And as the world was trying to recover from the atrocities of war, there were these investigators from places like West Germany and Israel and individuals who were tracking down Nazis, sifting through rumors, trying to hunt these men who would be ghosts.
And if you want to learn more about that, check out Operation Odessa, I think is the episode we did on that topic specifically.
We have a lot of Nazi episodes because they did a lot of terrible things. But the weirdest part here is when we're talking about the Nazis escaping to South America, we're talking about a true thing, a real event that went on for years. But we're also talking about all the rumors that built off that, like the idea that Adolf Hitler himself may have escaped. That's a story for another day. But today's episode is one people might not have heard of. It concerns the infamous Nazi doctor, the so-called Angel of Death, Joseph Mengele, and the conspiracy theory that he continued his horrific experiments long after the end of World War II. Today's episode, fellow conspiracy realist, what is Candido Godoy?
And what the hell is happening there?
Yes, here are the facts. It's a city you probably haven't heard of, unless you've heard of this story or unless you have visited a specific part of Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul.
So Candido Godoy is a city in Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil. It's a pretty small place. Population is somewhere between 6,000 and only 7,000. And you can find it close to the Argentine border. And there you'll find a small settlement in the city called Lina Sao Pedro. And that population is even smaller, with just a few hundred people there. It was founded by an original population of only 8 families back in 1918.
In their defense, these are big families.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. And if you don't mind, Ben, I'd like to pull in a quote here. There's a video that the BBC put out in 2018 that I won't tell you the name of right now, but there's a quote from an historian we're going to meet later, more in depth in this episode. But just according to him, he says there are like a slightly higher number there, I think 15 to 20 families. But again, it's like the original 8 families to, you know, maybe up to 20, essentially. Just putting that out there as like we're pretty sure it was a very few number of actual families that founded this place.
Right. And then later immigrants would come, but something unusual was happening because although Candido Godoy was colonized by the Spanish forces, the area now is primarily inhabited by descendants a little bit from Poland, but primarily German immigrants. And what's more, these immigrants mostly originate from a single region of Germany, a place called Hunsrück, which is also known for a weird tendency amongst its population. So if you go to Linha São Pedro, you'll immediately notice some odd things. First, people aren't speaking Portuguese as often as you would think. They tend to speak a German dialect. Secondly, you're going to see a lot of people who look alike because there are a ton of twins in Linha São Pedro, quite a few. It is noticeable when you walk through town. And for years, scientists have struggled and failed to discover why as many as 1 in 5 pregnancies in this area result in twins, most of them, according to the legends, being blonde-haired and blue-eyed.
Oh, very curious. So why? And how many are we talking? The birth rate stats for twins in Candido is 10%. Which is significantly higher than in the rest of the state, where it's only about 1.8%. So this is one of the highest, what you'd call twinning rates in the entire world. And this is a noteworthy pattern, at least during the early 20th century, when the first immigrants started to set a precedent, arriving with 17 sets of twins, amongst them. And if you visit the area today, you might still notice that it is, like you said, Ben, like instantly something that's remarkable, how many sets of twins you'll see just on a given day looking around.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about that. That's 1 in 10 kids that are born are kids instead of kid. I mean, yeah. That's crazy.
And the stats can, you know, you'll astute listeners, of course, you clocked that rate of twins was given as 10%, but then scientists also projected 1 in 5 pregnancies. We're aware of this discrepancy. Mm-hmm. It's coming from a couple of different sources, and of course, birth rates do change, or they vary over time. But yeah, it's a lot of twins.
Yeah, that 10%, I believe, in a particular study we looked at was between 1990 and 1994.
Right.
Well, we're also talking about 10% of a very small population, which makes it extra noticeable when you walk mm-hmm. in. It's like, wow, they're everywhere. And, you know, we know what a mystery twins still continue to be as to what leads to them, as to like their ability to communicate differently. You know, I mean, there's something that, you know, if you know anybody who has a twin sibling, they claim to, and, you know, I mean, honestly, you can't not believe them, have this kind of almost telekinetic ability, or this ability to kind of like feel things about each other from far distances, for example, or, you know, to be able to almost like speak without speaking to each other. It's very, very interesting, and not a lot is known about that. And that totally applies to this case, only this is an extra weird kind of twist. Like, why so many twins in this small area? And one of the theories is quite disturbing.
Yeah. And I do, just spoiler alert, have what I feel like is the explanation here. But let's walk through the crazy stuff. I want to step back because there was something I wanted to point out. So yeah, this is extraordinary because of the birth rate and the number of twins relative to the population. But for comparison, there are places that have, you know, in absolute numbers, much higher tendencies toward the production of twins. And Nigeria actually leads the world in this regard. Also, I always thought it would be cool to have a twin, but I think for most of us, the concept is incredibly alien. And that's why singles, right? Even if you have siblings, you're a single, right? In comparison to twins. That's why singles, like the majority of us in the audience today, are always fascinated by this. And the rumors of this connection, this idea of clairvoyance, this idea of unspoken communication. We're not the only people fascinated by this. Mengele was also fascinated by the idea of twins. And over the past few decades, various scientists, scholars, and historians have attempted to figure out just what causes this place, this tiny spot in Brazil, to produce so many twins. Locals have guests about this too, because, you know, they're the ones directly affected. So they might say that they have a couple of different theories. One of the most interesting, I think, is almost a horror movie trope. There's something in the water.
Yeah. Or it's, you know, a blessing in a weird way. It's a curse or a blessing, depending on how you look at it, if it were true, right? And just the concept that there's minerals or something about the pH or some specific thing about the rock formations where the water, you know, the tributaries are and everything, where it specifically gets to that one area. There are a few
that
rumors.
It affects ovulation, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, and that's, like we said, lore. That was a, you know, a legend, essentially. And there are a few others that, you know, maybe specific groups of locals had or rumors, but most of it had to do with, honestly, the most prominent one I saw there was water, or the one we're about to mention.
Right. There is another theory, and it's one that it's led people around the world on a very strange exploration down a very odd rabbit hole. One of the most disturbing theories to explain the twins of Candido Godoy is the idea that the infamous Nazi, Joseph Mengele, the Angel of Death, never really stopped his experiments. He just moved shop from Germany to Brazil. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll dive into this story ourselves. Here's where it gets crazy. The connection. When we're talking about this Angel of Death, first off, we have to learn a little bit more about who he is and what his weird deal with human experimentation and twins actually was.
Yeah, I mean, there's accounts I've read. You know, he was the notorious presence at the offloading sites where, you know, these undesirable races like the Jewish race, the Roma people, and LGBTQ population, for example, were rounded up in these cattle cars on the rail lines and then unloaded at these concentration camps. And he would kind of lurk around these places, you know, with his associates. And I read an account of a family, a mother and two twin daughters, and they heard, you know, one of the Nazi SS officers say, "Twins." And he looks at the mother and says, "Twins?" And she goes, "Yes, is that good?" And he goes, "Yes," and then takes them away, and they never see their mother again. And that's common because he was there like kind of trolling for twins, because that was a big part of something that he was fascinated with that he thought was would add to the efficacy of the bizarre experiments that he was doing. That included everything from disfigurement, artificial insemination, what else, Ben? I mean, it's, you know, maiming, just literally like trying to see how the human body would react to the most horrible, despicable conditions.
Yeah, I would just say likely that comes from the account of Ava Moses Kaur, mm-hmm. who told her entire story in a series of writings and documentaries. And she says that specifically the twins were all taken and placed in a separate barracks away from everybody else. And they were separated by what Mengele considered their gender at the time, girls and boys. And they had a very rigid schedule that they kept to. According to Ava, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, they would have to all walk over to a building that was called Auschwitz One. And there, Mengele and other doctors and others just working for them would measure them, essentially run diagnostic tests on their bodies, and do comparisons between the two twins. Then on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, that's when a lot of the experimentation would happen. They called it the blood lab, or Ava at least called it the blood lab. And there would be, she said, around 30 children in this one area. They would all sit in chairs and they would have their arms strapped down. And in one of their arms, they would have blood taken out for testing. And the other arm, they would have injections where who knows what's being put into them, but they would get injections.
A lot of that is lost to history, mm-hmm. actually, the efficacy. I think the important point we need to make here is the distinction. This comes up when we talk about Nazi war crimes, as well as Unit 731 in Japan. there is a distinction here that needs to be made between what would be considered human experimentation and what would be considered torture. The methodology of a lot of these so-called scientists was unsound because their aim was – it had the patina of scientific rigor, but these are war crimes. And a lot of the science that was derived from those activities turns out not to be good, not to be super worthwhile. For Mengele, the thing is that people know about the twins, but while he, like many people, was fascinated by twins, he's a very, very bad person. He is in direct violation of things like the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm, right? He was literally one of the people who would select folks to go straight to the gas chambers or to be worked to death or subjected to experiments. And all of his underlings and all of his collaborators had been given special instructions, not just to find twins, but to find people who were dwarves or little people, to find people who were extraordinarily large or tall, anyone with a unique, what we would recognize as a hereditary trait, like heterochromia, eyes of a slightly different color, or a clubfoot, or even polydactyl people, if those turned up, and extra fingers, we mean, more than the usual five per hand. And the reason when he had these twins, the horrific things that he was doing to them while the rest of their family is also being tortured and put to death here, these horrific things the scope of them can be found just in the following statistic. They pulled about 3,000 twins, right, over the course of Mengele's time in Germany. When he was in Auschwitz, and most of those twins were children. Of those 3,000, only 200 survived, and really, in a very real way, against all odds. So this guy, let me give you his rationalization, why I was doing this. So he was doing this not just because he's a horrible person, but also because Adolf Hitler had given him instructions to figure out ways to increase the population of what he considered to be the master race, aka the Aryans. And Mengele was researching twins because the logic here, if logic existed, was the idea that if we can figure out what creates twins, then we can go to the people we want to reproduce and we can do something to them. We can affect their biology such that every birth they have will result in twins, or heck, you know, triplets, who knows, though they were twin focused, right? And that if we can do that, we will essentially be doubling our birth rate. That was their logic.
It's a two for one deal. I mean, really, it is just absolute that Nazi efficiency that everything needs to kind of serve a purpose and you don't have any waste or whatever. And the thing that's most terrific to me as well about these, you're absolutely right, Ben. I mean, absolutely unsound science, and you really could just classify it as torturing, is he would use one twin as like the experiment subject and then use the other one as a control. And if my understanding is correct, they would often be made to watch each other be tortured.
Yeah, that's horrifying. I want to bring up something, and this is complete speculation on my part, guys, but I just want to ask you what you think about this. It is known that in the upper echelons of the Nazi Party, there was a belief, there was a lot of magical thinking, and there were some odd beliefs there that I think may have also led to a further fascination with twins, as in a possible connection beyond the physical. If that makes sense. And I do wonder if any beliefs there led to this fascination as well, because you know, you'll notice we're not talking about them experimenting on the mothers, the people who birthed twins.
Right.
Right. We're not talking about a focus on the fathers who, you know, created twins. It's on the twins themselves. And I just wonder, and again, this is me just thinking aloud. I wonder if there was something more to that fascination.
Well, there's a lot of folklore. in Germany surrounding twins, like the Alces, which were a pair of twin brother gods that were worshipped by Germanic peoples and survives. And we know at a time, and again, this is just a line of, we're just freestyling, this mm-hmm. is speculation here, but we know that there was a movement in the party to generate a new kind of religion, right? Or to, you know, replace the concept of Christianity that was popular. So there could be some symbolism motivating people in that way. But long story short, before you spend too much time with Mengele in Germany, spoiler alert, and this is a good spoiler, Nazi Germany lost World War II. For a number of reasons. If you haven't caught up with that one, yes, that Nazi Germany lost World War II, and the people in power found themselves desperate to escape justice and to escape the various forces that wanted to hold them to account for their crimes. So the war draws to a close. Germany is falling. Mengele travels to South America in 1949 in July. He sails to Argentina, and he has the help of the Rat Line, a network of other former SS members and Nazi sympathizers, many of whom were associated with the church. They were getting these people new identities. They were giving them supplies from, you know, all the stuff they stole during World War II was providing funding for these folks. And so for about a decade, the Angel of Death is living in and around Buenos Aires in just under an assumed name. And the heat hasn't caught up to him. But when he starts to feel something shift in the wind, he flees first to Paraguay and then to Brazil. And when he reaches Brazil, it's 1960.
If you're interested in a remarkably historically inaccurate but relatively interesting show to watch around this type of stuff, there's a show called Hunters starring Al Pacino, where it's like this very fictionalized, almost like ragtag band of like sort of, you know, an A-team kind of situation where it's these Nazi hunters. They're looking for, you know, war criminal Nazis. And there are things in it that are based on reality, but it's absolutely overblown and embellished and Hollywoodized. I believe Ben coined that last episode. But it's worth a watch. It's not great, but it's interesting.
Much like the Arrogant Bastards? I forget which one.
Inglourious Bastards. It's Quentin Tarantino style, I would say. I was mm-hmm. surprised. Watching Hunters, I was surprised to learn that he wasn't the one making it.
Right. I was also surprised with kind of how far they go down some of the more uncomfortable territories of this type of thing. It almost made it a little unpleasant at times, it being such a kind of schlocky, grandiose, you know, kind of revisionist history type show. But I leave it to you to decide what you think of the show Hunters. Let us know. And this is exactly what Mengele was going through. He was a wanted man. He was on the lam. He was being hunted by officials from West Germany and Israel who were, you know, in cooperation in this endeavor. And that included people like Simon Wiesenthal. All of these individuals wanted to bring him and those like him to justice for his absolutely despicable war crimes, because let's make no mistake, that is what these were. He was holding people against their will and performing, you know, inhumane experiments on them, and as you said, Ben, resulting in thousands and thousands of deaths. But Mengele was a smart guy. You know, he knew what he was doing in terms of, you know, plotting his escape. He had the right idea. And in 1979,
well, and he had a lot of help.
That's what I'm saying. He worked with the right people. Exactly. And then there was this network that was established, these rat lines, like you said. And many did get caught, but many escaped. And it's sort of that almost trope you see in a lot of fiction about like the Nazi war criminal, you know, pretending to be a mild mannered old man living next door to you in the suburbs. I believe that happens as well in The Marathon Man, the character that does the played by Laurence Olivier, who does the, you know, dental torture. That's a, you know, an escaped Nazi war criminal, or it's supposed to be, who I believe is also called the Angel of Death, if I'm not mistaken, in the movie. It's not the same Angel of Death, I don't believe, but that is his nickname. So He assumes a false name, Wolfgang Gerhard, and they don't find his true identity until 1985. He dies, by the way, of natural causes, more or less, of a stroke in 1979 while having a nice swim off the Brazilian coast, and he drowns. But again, he's been masquerading as this Wolfgang Gerhard character, and his true identity isn't determined until 1985 when his remains are exhumed and forced to be subject to forensic analysis.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a very real sense, he got away. Mm-hmm. And all they know is that there was a real Wolfgang Gerhard at some point. That guy left the picture and Mengele became him. So,
well, and we know that he had, I think, at least three names that
probably
he went,
more.
Or yeah, but I know of three off the top of my head. So he was definitely changing, chameleoning.
Well, he was doing that out of necessity because you do want to have more than one. It's kind of like doing a shell company, right? You want it because each one will make you more difficult to trace, but it also requires more work on your part or for whomever's handling you. So in this situation, what probably happened is he had to burn some of these personas because he was on the run the entire time.
It's that classic twist in the movie when the nosy neighbor is snooping around in the suspicious German man's house when he's off, you know, going to the grocery store and finds a drawer with like six different passports in it, you know, all with different names. And that's sort of like the aha moment. But that was real. And I'm sure he had, you know, things like valuables that he had smuggled out as well that he was living on. You know, you picture like loose diamonds or something like that, right?
Yeah, a lot of those guys were supported by things that they had stolen from their victims during the course of the war or things they made off with from the state as the regime was collapsing. But here we are. So let's put aside fiction for a second. Real life, 1949 to 1979, under various personas, Joseph Mengele was in South America in multiple countries for three decades. What the hell was he getting up to down there? According to controversial claims by some historians, one of whom we'll examine in depth, Mengele never stopped his experiments with twins specifically. At this point, we introduce an Argentine historian named Jorge Camarasa. Jorge Camarasa is a specialist in the post-war Nazi flight to South America. And he spent a lot of time tracing these individuals' activities, putting the pieces of the puzzle together, right? Hunting down a person who didn't want to be found, right? Proving the ghost was real. This war criminal's life across this continent is detailed by Camarasa in his book, Mengele, The Angel of Death in South America. And in this book, this guy made a tremendous splash when he said Mengele did continue his experiments, specifically in Candido Godoy and specifically with twins. He is convinced that by the 1960s, Mengele somehow cracked the code to creating twins, and he used his knowledge to permanently alter something about the population of Candido. In his specific quote, he says, "I think Candido Godoy may have been Mengele's laboratory, where he finally managed to fulfill his dreams of creating a master race of blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryans." So the big question, first question we have to have here is, what is this guy basing his claim on? And then secondly, I hate that we have to mention this, but we do. Is he just trying to sell a book? That's a question that comes up a lot with these kinds of stories. And we're not casting aspersion on him right now. It's just, it's an understandable question. And it's one that his critics will also mention, and we'll meet them in a few minutes. But right now, the most interesting part about his claim is that residents of Candido Godoy appear to verify it. They at least say that Mengele was there.
Yeah, they say that he visited numerous times in the 1960s. And when he showed up, he was essentially a doctor, but a veterinarian. So he would show up and he would offer medical treatment, you know, for animals and for women in the town as this, you know, veterinarian. A bit strange. And you can see the pieces kind of fitting together if you're hearing these as anecdotes from people who live there, right? Let's just imagine you're the author and you're trying to research as much of this as you can. And there are local legends that this guy was definitely in town and he, you know, was this character when he was here. You can imagine, just as you said, Ben, that you believe at least that your beliefs then are correct, or at least it would assist in that. And there's one resident there. Person's name is Oloisi, perhaps Finkler. This person is a farmer. And this is a quote about Mengele. He asked about illnesses we had among our animals and told us not to worry. He could cure them. He appeared a cultured and dignified man. Isn't that interesting that, yeah. that I can cure this thing? It reminds me of the right. cult you, discussion.
You know, anyway. a cow is not so different biologically from a woman. Right. That's the kind of reasoning, just to show you how creepy it is.
That is creepy. But didn't he have some practical knowledge of livestock and he was doing some functional good? Like they had TB and he gave them some kind of vaccine. Like he just kind of like helped them, or was it all just wild, you know, medical quackery? Ooh,
well, let's go to another quote from Leonardo Bufler. There's also a farmer in the area. And says, yeah, Mengele was visiting them under the guise of being a veterinarian. Bufler says, quote, he went from farm to farm checking the animals. He checked them for TB and injected those that were infected. He also said he could carry out artificial insemination of cows and humans, which we thought impossible, as in those days, it was unheard of. So even if we put aside the larger theory that he was actively creating twins in this small environment, it's already very disturbing the way that this dude is infiltrating this community by posing as a useful, helpful force, a veterinarian, and then leveraging that somehow to gain access to the humans, to their bodies, and to participate somehow in observing or influencing their reproductive process the same way he would with livestock. That is messed up, man.
If these accounts are true, like if these folks actually identified, you know, this person, this guy, whoever his name was at the time, as Mengele.
And Camarasa traces Mengele's path, and he claims that this guy first, like we said, went to Paraguay to another German enclave called Colonias Unidas. And then from there, in 1963, he started making regular trips, the historian says, to the German community just over the border in Brazil, Candido Godoy. But if you look at research, because a lot of people have been involved in trying to figure this out, not just the twin thing, but also this Nazis association. So you'll see local historians, local doctors, local mayors or former mayors all have their different takes on this, down to the local historian who runs the museum, which you'll meet him in a second. But let's meet town doctor, former town doctor, Anuncia Flores da Silva. He set off to solve the mystery of the Candido twins, and he interviewed hundreds of people. And De Silva, at one moment, notices something odd. In a lot of these conversations, there's a name that keeps coming up, a mysterious medic / veterinarian who called himself Rudolf Weiss.
That's right. And De Silva had this to say about it. He talks about the testimonies that he collected where they were looking through the names of women who were treated by this Rudolf Weiss. It seemed that he was some sort of rural medic who would go from house to house. And he would, you know, help women with various conditions, including things like varicose veins, which he claimed to have some sort of cure-all that he carried around in a bottle, or these tablets that he would bring with him. He would also occasionally do dental work. Of the most important detail, everyone remembers he would always take a blood sample, which is odd, if you're just doing work on somebody, that's not really part of the equation, right?
Yeah. And it's weird because this same doctor was interviewed by the BBC and gave a very different quote. But specifically, he is saying definitely Mengele was here, like for sure he was here. But I don't think he experimented on anybody. So it's just very strange because, you know, we're not describing experimentation here. We're describing perhaps a doctor helping out in some way.
We're also describing observation.
Exactly.
Observation at the very least, right? So this leads us to the next twist in our journey. Could this be true? Could this theory, this conspiracy theory, be true? We are going to tell you the definitive answer after a word from our sponsors. And we've returned. Side note, longtime listeners, you know that it's somewhat rare for us to go, yes, we have the answer, and we'll get to it. So we're not fooling with you. No smoke. We do know the answer. Right now, most experts will not agree with the claims of the historian Camarasa. We want to introduce to you a Dr. Ursula Mate of the Medical Genetics Unit at Porto Alegre Hospital in Brazil. She and her colleagues reject any notion whatsoever that Mengele was responsible for this phenomenon, and they put the work in. Her team went there during 1994. They wanted to investigate the reports of a higher than average number of twin births, and they found it was legit. They found a ton of twins. They did blood tests on 17 of the 22 pairs of twins. About half of those pairs were identical twins. And Mate says, I'm paraphrasing for her here, but Mate says, look, you don't need a mad scientist to explain this.
Yeah. And this time period, remember, that's the 1 in 10 births, the 1990 to 1994, just to give some context there. And she goes on to say, quote, even though we could not find a definitive explanation for this higher incidence, the existence of other twin towns around the world, most of them in remote isolated areas with high levels of inbreeding, just as in São Pedro, shows that external influence is not needed for this to happen.
Yeah, so for her, the primary issues are twofold, and there's not a Nazi involved. It's isolation and inbreeding, and this allows an ordinarily recessive trait or quality to flourish. And she's careful to note that experts still, as we said, do not fully understand the entirety of the mechanisms that are involved in the creation of twins. But she says it's extremely difficult to think that Mengele would have known about this kind of stuff in the late 1960s. This would have been sci-fi level technology for him to understand this, or for him to be able to not only fully understand that mechanism, but to somehow alter it or set it into motion. Because what she says, our real culprit here is not the angel of death, in her opinion. It is something that is today understood to as the founder effect, which is a cool name for a dangerous thing.
And just as a callback here, remember, we stated that only somewhere between 8 and 20 families founded this village, this city, this place.
Right. Yeah. After that initial 8 families, there were more that came, but they were, again, from the same area of Germany that is also known for its higher than average number of twins. So people sharing the same genetic history, first several large families, like 8 large families come, and then more families come from the same area, and this becomes the kernel of this settlement. So what we're saying is a relatively homogenous population in the world of genetics, that's a bad thing often.
Yeah.
Founder effect describes a loss in genetic variation that happens when you take a sample of organisms from a larger population, very small sample, and then you put them somewhere else and don't let them interact with other organisms. And you just sort of see what happens as their genes bounce around each other in this sort of biological version of a bottle episode. on television, right? We all know what a bottle episode is.
It always reminds me of that scene in The Lion King where Scar accuses some character of coming from the shallow end of the gene pool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not bad at all. Yeah, and a bottle episode is the thing where your characters are stuck somewhere and they can't really go anywhere. They just sort of bounce off each other. Genetically, that's what's happening, the founder effect. And what this means is, and this is actually fascinating, and I believe it'll play a big role in the coming era of space travel. When you have a new population that is experiencing founder's effect, their lack of genetic diversity can create over time something distinct and different from that original larger population. And this is happening. This has happened around the world. You can find examples of this in the most extreme cases, which would have to happen over a long period of time and probably with a lot of catastrophes along the way. In the most extreme cases, founder's effect could lead to speciation and later evolution of a new species. Why is this interesting for space travel? Because it's a long way to Mars. We're talking about long distances, right? And if you build an ark ship and people are living and reproducing on it instead of, you know, in some sort of state of suspended animation, then that could also lead to speciation. You could, you know, it's quite possible that you could arrive on a planet that had been founded or, you know, infiltrated by humans long ago, and you wouldn't quite recognize the humans that you found when you landed.
That's
amazing.
Right.
Amazing.
Yes, Ben, Mars travel. It's the new Galapagos.
There we are. Oh, that's good. Put on a t-shirt. Yes. But this is, I mean, That still feels like the realm of science fiction, but we know that founder's effect could very easily apply to future space colonists. And you can see the early stages of founder's effect in Brazil's Twin Town. So far, neither the historian Camarasa nor any other adherent of the Mengele theory has been able to prove that Mengele actually conducted experiments. People have only been able to prove he came to the place, he visited on a regular basis, he pretended to be a veterinarian, he did treat animals, and he probably did it as a way to gain access to the human population, a way to gain trust. So back to Dr. Mate, right? That's one of the big questions a lot of us have listening today. What about the DNA, right? We can do that now. So she conducted a series of DNA tests on about 30 families with a team. She had a team of 20 researchers, and they've been working on that since 2009, and they found a specific gene in the population that appears, they phrase it carefully. They say it appears more frequently in mothers of twins than in mothers without twins. So they can have at least a partial predictor. But she notes a couple other things that bust the Mengele theory, because she says the prevalence of twin births, like they went back through church records and stuff, and she says the prevalence of twin births dates back to the 1930s, it dates back probably even earlier. It's years and years before Mengele would have ever been on the scene. And then they also, to your point, Matt, because I think this is one that was a really popular theory for a while, they also analyzed the water.
Yeah, and they found absolutely no abnormalities within the water, no specific mineral, no anything. No chemicals that were being leached for some reason or another, or elements. It was pretty good water. So that was 2009. So they started studying in 1994. Then they're studying again 2009. I believe the paper that I looked into, at least the abstract of it, was released or published in 2011. And you can read it if you're so inclined.
Yeah, yeah, and it is fascinating, because there is something, you know, with no disrespect to the population of this area, there is something extraordinary and odd, unusual occurring there. The residents of Candido Godoy today continue to create an abnormally high number of twins. The twin birth rate is real. It continues. And every now and again, an expert, a journalist, a tourist, or just someone curious will visit to experience this mystery firsthand. And for the record, in general, the residents are happy to, you know, allow you to take a picture with them and so on. Just be very careful. Remember, please remember, always be respectful. And if you are walking up to some people you don't know in a country you are not familiar with, ask permission before you take a photo. It can very easily become a violation of several taboos or mores. In fact, you can be attacked sometimes, especially if you're taking photos of children, right? So ask in a respectful manner. And if they're cool with it, then yes, you can get the photo. Due to its macabre associations, that theory about Joseph Mengele, the idea that he somehow had hidden science and affected the local population, that theory is probably going to continue, even though it's incredibly unlikely that he was responsible for this phenomenon. It's just, it helps people sell books. It helps with tourism. There are reasons people would want to propagate this legend.
He likely did roll through there.
Oh, he definitely visited. Yeah, more than once. He was there. Yeah.
And he was probably very interested in the town and wanted to stick around, but was probably fearful of being caught. And it goes back to that that doctor's quote about, I don't think he experimented on people because in order to do that, he would be giving himself away in many aspects. Not necessarily, he wouldn't have to say, I'm Dr. Mengele, but he would, by doing some kind of invasive experimentation there, he would almost like be letting his guard down, I would say, or letting a veil up.
You have to wonder what he did with the blood, though, which out of context is a really weird sentence to say.
Yeah.
But you're right, right. That's a big question. Like, would he have risked exposing himself? Because he was careful. He died under a different name in peaceful circumstances and never saw a day in court. So it's likely, given what we know about him, that he would have known just how extraordinarily rare this population was. And he would have been fascinated by it. He probably would have returned, he was observing, he was paying attention. We don't know what conclusions he was drawing or if he did have any aims for experimentation because, like you said, Matt, I noticed this too, it is not as if he could have published a paper on his research, right? Because any German in South America at this time publishing a paper on research in twins...
That's a red flag right there. Yeah.
But you also have to imagine, like, I mean, his fascination with this from the onset, you know, bordered on obsession. And he did so many experiments that were just not rooted in anything but his own morbid curiosity, it would seem. I mean, he had a goal, but there is part of me that thinks you don't really lose that drive, you know, when you get older. If anything, like, I mean, he's probably bored and, like, you know, just kind of crawling out of his skin. God, horrible expression there for him. But maybe he just, you know, wanted to keep things interesting and did, you know, do a couple on the lowdown. Because, I mean, let's not lie. This guy's a mass murderer. He's a psychopath, you know, I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, I want to leave the door open just a little bit, if that's okay with this one. All I want to mention is that there was a BBC small piece put out in 2018 where a photojournalist, a video journalist traveled there, interviewed several people, including the mayor, including that doctor we mentioned, and the historian. And in 2018, there's still genetic testing occurring. It's not as though the 2011 study just, you know, absolutely stamped it, you know, conclusive, we're done. It definitely shows that, like, there's a very high likelihood that the founder effect is, you know, explains what is occurring there and what has occurred there. But there's still the community itself is still very much interested in finding more about what's happening and their, you know, their own genes and their ancestry and why So there are geneticists there likely right now, at least as of 2018, like Augusto Santos, who is, you know, they're taking the DNA kits that you may have seen before with like the 23andMe using saliva to further test the twin populations and the mothers just to find out, I guess, just more about what the heck is happening and why.
Yeah. And this is important too, because the founder's effect, which is probably what this is, the founder's effect can have can pose serious dangers to a population as time continues. There are, you know, higher rates of certain diseases or medical conditions in isolated populations across the planet. So when you are researching these conditions in researching this phenomenon in these communities, you have a very real possibility of being able to help address genetic issues down the line. And this is not just important, I would argue, for these communities. Of course, it is a huge priority there, but it's also important for the human species overall. So these geneticists are doing incredibly important work. And I know a lot of us probably weren't expecting to talk about space travel in this episode of all things, wasn't. But it will, like, the larger point is that this research is going to arm the human species with some profound knowledge that will come in handy in the coming millennia. And, you know, that's way out there. I know that's very much a tangent, but what's happening now, just like you said, Matt, is important to the present, the past, and the future. And we're also fortunate that we have research capable of dispelling this mystery, because one of the things that always bugs me is like the glamorization of, you know, various Nazi ideas through conspiracy, you know. And what's great about this story is that we found good, diligent scientists won out over mad scientists. Unless, that is, you have proof. You have proof that Mengele did something that somehow further accelerated the production of twins. If you do, we'd love to hear it. Let us know. We try to be easy to find online.
That's right. You can find us on the usual internet locations of note. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. Both of those are Conspiracy Stuff. You can find us on Instagram at Conspiracy Stuff Show. And Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we are also Conspiracy Stuff on YouTube.
Yes, that is correct. Check it out. Pull up your Oculus and watch us in 3D / in a virtual environment / it's not really 3D, it's just a virtual environment. It's fun. I just tried it. It's weird as heck. But you can watch Ben, and he's like 40 feet tall looming over you. And I don't know, it's worth it. Try it out. See how it plays for you. I loved it. So yeah, YouTube definitely for sure. And hey, if you're listening to this via, you know, audio, we ask that you please review the podcast if you have not already, wherever you listen. It doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter how you review it. Just getting feedback from you is great. We love it. We want it. It helps the show out. We do appreciate it. Thank you. If you don't want to do that stuff, but you still want to interact with us, we've got a phone number.
That's right. We do. You can give us a ring right now. 1-833-STDWYTK. You'll hear a message at the top just to let you know you're in the right place. And then you've got 3 minutes. Go nuts. Like, go bananas with it. Go crazy. Give yourself a moniker, a sick nickname. You can use your government name if you want. We don't care. It's more important for you to let us know if we can use your voice and or message on the air. And if there's something that you want to just tell us, but maybe don't feel like sharing with the rest of the world, that's fine. Just tack it on at the end. But most importantly, do not feel like you have to censor yourself. Do not feel like you need to call repeatedly. Do not feel like you need to squish a 10-minute story into 3 minutes. Give that story the air it needs to breathe. Write to us. Tell us the whole thing. We read every letter we get. You can send them along right now at our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.